You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, Director of the John Cage Trust, welcoming you to Part 2 of John Cage at Wesleyan University, this week's program devoted to a conversation with one of Cage's most beloved colleagues, Neely Bruce. Bruce is a professor of music and American studies at Wesleyan, where he's been since 1974. As you'll learn from our conversation together, he earned his undergraduate degree from the University of Alabama at Tuscaloosa and his DMA from the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, where his principal teachers were Ben Johnston, Charles Hamm, and Salima Stravinsky. While at the University of Illinois, Neely met and worked with Cage during Cage's own residency there in the late 1960s, appearing in both Cage's Music Circus in 1967 and in the premiere performance of Cage's Harpsichord in 1969, a work he frequently reprised in performance for years after. Neely would go on to become well known for his association with Cage and his works, which included his directing the American Theater Group's stellar performance of Cage's songbooks in 1979. In 1988, he planned and executed a major symposium about Cage and his cultural influences, titled John Cage at Wesleyan, which featured many of the finest Cage performers of the day. The symposium still resonates for everyone who was in attendance. In 1992, the year of Cage's death, he was among the participants of the now legendary Cage Music Circus, presented by Essential Music and Andrew Culver, given on November 1st, 1992, at New York's Symphony Space, along with such others as Laurie Anderson, Larry Austin, Irvine Arditi, Earl Brown, Stephen Drury, Anaya Lockwood, Jackson Maclow, Ivar Mikishoff, Gordon Mumma, and a host of others. When I first approached Neely about doing a show together for All Things Cage, I asked him if he could speak to Cage's influence on his own substantial work as a composer. Neely has produced numerous works for the stage, operas and dramatic pieces, music for films, plays, and the dance, vocal music for both liturgical and non-liturgical settings, music for all manner of instrumental ensembles, including orchestra, and lots of works for keyboard and other solo instruments. He delighted me by producing a document he had produced years before on this very subject. After much discussion and listening, we decided to play a few of his beautiful gymnopédies at the close of tonight's program, all inspired by Erik Satie, of course, but also by John Cage's love of the French composer. Neely is affable, energetic, and optimistic, and it's no wonder that Cage spoke with such fondness of him right up to his death in 1992. So welcome to All Things Cage, Neely. It's great to see you.
Great to see you, Laura. Thanks for inviting me.
It's totally my pleasure. We're doing part two of John Cage at Wesleyan University this week with Neely Bruce. Neely was one of Cage's closest colleagues at Wesleyan for a very long time, and long after Cage had left Wesleyan. Neely, I'd love to know. So John Cage, we know, went to Wesleyan around 1960. He did a couple of performances with David Tudor before that, but he started his own career at Wesleyan as a member of the Center for Advanced Study, which he attended twice. We went over those in last week's program. And he's just fell in love with you when you came there in 1974. So he had been there for almost 15 years by the time you got there. This is probably a presumptuous question, but was Cage part of the reason you went to Wesleyan?
Oh, that's a very complicated question, Laura.
That's okay.
I basically felt like I had been, this is a short version of a very long story. I felt that I had been at the University of Illinois long enough, and there was an opening at Wesleyan for the choral conductor job, and I applied for it in the early summer of 1974. I got the position, and I left Illinois over the summer, which pleased Wesleyan very much, didn't please Illinois that much. But that's the short version, as I say, of a long and convoluted story. I actually knew John pretty well before I got to Wesleyan, because I had met him through my teacher, Ben Johnston. I had recorded his harpsichord piece, the HPSCHD, which he and Jerry Hiller composed. I was in the premiere of that. I'm on the first recording of it. I had done other things at Illinois with John. I saw him fairly regularly. Some of the other graduate students and I started a chess club, and we invited John to come and play chess with us, which he did a couple of times, but it didn't last, but it was really fun. He's extremely serious as a chess player, by the way.
Yep.
It's not a social occasion. It was not a social occasion. It was a very serious gamesmanship sort of situation. And of course, he was famous for being John. I think the first time I actually saw him in person was on the stage of Smith Hall at the University of Illinois, where he read stories from Silence to accompany the famous dance of Merce Cunningham, How to Pass, Kick, Fall, and Run, which was the most exhilarating piece of dance I ever seen at that point, and I think still ranks as one of the high points in my dance viewing life, which is considerable.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. That's actually part of the indeterminacy score now. They're not just Silence, but they're from a lot of different places, and he kept working on them for decades.
I wondered about that because, you know, when I saw him do it twice. They did it the first time at Smith Hall and the second time in the Assembly Hall at the University of Illinois, which is, of course, a vast barn of a space as opposed to the intimacy of Smith Hall, which was much more conducive to really understanding the impact of the piece. But I thought it was pretty much the same then, but it's interesting that he kept adding and subtracting.
Exactly. And by the way, last week's show, I know that you haven't quite gotten to the end of that yet, Neely, but you'll hear, I put in about, I don't know what it is, 35 or 40 minutes, maybe not quite that much, half hour of Cage reading indeterminacy stories.
Uh-huh.
Because I do play that, or I read the address to the gentlemen of the Wesleyan Glee Club, which is so storytelling for Cage. You know, it's so full of stories, including a couple of indeterminacy stories. So I thought it'd be nice to close the program with more of that.
Yes.
Anyway, is the upshot of what you were just saying about, in answer to my question about, was Cage part of the reason you went to Wesleyan? It sounds like Cage was a bonus.
Well, he was more than a bonus. Cage was part of the Wesleyan mystique. Let's put it this way. I mean, even I didn't know a lot about Wesleyan, but my closest friend in graduate school was Bill Brooks, who we're still very much in touch. And of course, he has written extensively on Cage, and he's a Wesleyan alum, and he had filled me in on many things about Wesleyan, which sounded extremely attractive. And Richard Winslow's piece, Job, which is an oratorio, a very fine oratorio, by the way, Bill had conducted it at Illinois, and I was in that performance. So I knew about Winslow's music, and I knew that Winslow had brought Cage to Wesleyan, and I knew a lot of the circumstances of the whole thing. But I didn't know that much about the school itself, which had a fairly low profile in those days, much higher profile now, of course. For all kinds of reasons, not just John, but because Alvin Lussier spent his career here almost entirely. And it's just got a lot going. He's got the World Music Program and so on and so forth. Well, these things were established, but not in their infancy, but in their childhood, perhaps, is the best way to put it. All of this got going not that long before I came to Wesleyan. And when I came here, it had only been co-ed for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
I don't think I knew that. I don't think that I knew that Wesleyan was ever not co-ed.
It was an all-male school.
Uh-huh.
When the Wesleyan Glee Club was around, that was all men.
Of course.
The famous concerts that John and David Tudor did at Wesleyan in the Wesleyan Chapel and at the Center for Humanities. The school was all male at that point. I think it's literally fall of 1972.
Uh-huh. And Lussier came, I think it was in 70, right? If I remember his biography.
Yes.
Yeah. So you came shortly after.
Actually, Alvin I didn't know that Alvin was at Wesleyan. That actually impressed me more than anything else, because people, I think, would have a hard time today realizing how notorious Alvin was and how famous I Am Sitting in a Room was at that time. And I remember feeling sort of gobsmacked when I learned that Alvin was at Wesleyan. I said, "Ah, Wesleyan! Alvin Lucy is at Wesleyan University." That I thought was the pièce de résistance.
Right.
I simply had to take this job if it was going to be offered to me, and it was. It turned out.
Yeah. That's fantastic. John adored you. I mean, he spoke about you all the time. We're talking later years when I was around.
Well,
you know,
it was a mutual admiration society. And I don't know that people are also aware of this, but, you know, John was an extremely generous person, you know, in every way. He helped my various projects of mine with direct financial support. But more than that, he was moral support. I remember one conversation with him. Everybody gets disgruntled with his employer at one time or another. And I was thinking, you know, maybe I should just get out of academia and just, you know, move to New York and be done with teaching school. And of course I discussed this with John. It was my habit to discuss by that time to discuss any major considerations with him. And he was very quiet, and he just sort of listened and politely. And then he said, "I think you're handling it very well."
It's so sweet.
I thought, well, that was okay. I'm staying at Wesleyan. I'm not getting out of academia. But of course, he didn't try to lecture me or anything, or tell me what to do. He just said, "I think you're handling it very well." I don't do a good cage imitation, but I'm sure you can understand the.
You know, I did my graduate work at UCLA, and I did a doctoral dissertation on Cage. And Cage asked me, after I gave him a copy of it, he said, "What are you going to do now that you're graduating?" And I told him, I said, I've gotten 2 teaching offers. I'm probably going to go into teaching. To which he said, "Oh, no." I said, "What do you mean, oh, no?" And the reason I said that was because I was aware that most of the people that he loved the most in life were teachers. It was, you know, there was you, there was Charles Dodge, there was Alvin Lucier. There were people, you know, he really had this enormous respect for teachers, but he just thought that, you know, that academe sort of took the life out of you when you were in academe.
Well, I think it does for some people, and some people thrive in it.
Yes, I think you're right. I think I responded to him by saying something like, what's wrong with teaching? John, teaching is, what better life is there to spend time with people younger than you and teaching them what you know and sharing work? And it sounds fantastic to me. And he said, "Oh, you mean teaching."
Well, you know, I don't want to get sidetracked, because we really should be talking about John. But a lot of people get into the academic life, and it's what to say. It's very good for realizing some of your life goals, and it's not so good for other of your life goals. Let's say if you want to be a world famous performer, right? Academia is not going to cut it. I mean, there are a handful of people who've made that work, but only a handful. What you really have to do is take the plunge. And, you know, no one in his right mind could imagine Horowitz, for example, as a professor at a conservatory. Almost, I mean, some famous people end up in conservatories, but they're not particularly happy there, it seems to me.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And, I remember thinking, fair enough. You know, fair enough that he felt that way. But I wanted to give it a try. And he always thought, he always sort of spoke to me about that. He thought I would be an excellent dean, that I should be a dean.
Oh, yes. Actually, you would be an excellent And here you are running a big collection. You know.
That's right. There you go. So it's kind of dean-like.
You have an administrative post. It's tangentially academic.
That's right. It is tangentially. Yeah. I don't teach full-time anymore, alas. I really like teaching. You know, I really enjoy it.
Well, teaching is great. You can, even if you don't have the best students, you're reviewing what you know, and it always looks fresh. You know, when you're teaching it to somebody else.
Yeah, no, it's true, and you can bring your enthusiasm back into the fold.
Yes.
Yeah, I know, I know. But let's go back to Cage because I really have all these questions for you. Like, for example, you're an amazing composer, Neely. You yourself, we could talk about nothing but your own work. But I want to know how much of the innovations of your work were you bring were brought out before you even were aware of Cage.
Well,
Do
that's
you know what I
true.
mean? It's a hard question to ask.
Well, it is a hard question to ask, but I kind of know the dates. I started composing when I was 9 years old, and I am a pack rat, and I've kept every piece of paper I've ever scribbled notes on. And I re remember being aware of John when I was in undergraduate school at the University of Alabama. And I actually read Silence, which was brand new at the time. When I was a senior at the University of Alabama, I was sort of steered in the direction of John's thinking and John's music by David Cohen, who was one of the composition professors there, and the person who brought computer music to the University of Alabama. He got a big grant from the Ford Foundation to establish a program in computer music there in the mid-60s. I think very few people realize what a hotbed of music the University of Alabama was, and still is in many ways, but there were lots of very exciting things going on there. And we had, above all, we had the Southeastern Regional Composers Forum, which met every year at the University of Alabama. And I met Milton Babbitt there, for example, at Alabama. He came as one of the teach or the, one of the composers who came for that conference. I met Jean Eichelberger Ivey there. She was featured in one of the years, and Ian Hamilton, who's not remembered very much, but he was a hardcore serial composer who taught at Duke University. Very fine composer. Well, he was great. He should be revived. David Cohen should be revived too. But who else was it? Henry Cowell came one year, and this was shortly before he died. He and Alvin Ettler were shared the guest composer thing that year, and they unfortunately didn't have much to do with the students. They just went around all over the campus and talk to each other. Both had these long, big black overcoats. They were quite something, going around talking to each other. But anyway, I did meet Henry Cowell. I did meet Alvin Ettler. I didn't meet Cage there, but he never came there to my his book.
Alabama preceded Illinois for you,
Correct,
right?
correct. Now, then I went to Illinois the summer of 1965, and I think the performance that I mentioned of How to Pass, Kick, Fall, and Run took place in the spring of 1967 or the winter of 1960s. Anyway, it was in the second year that I was there. And that spring, he came as a guest lecturer in one of the classes of Charles Ham. Charles Ham taught a course in American music, and he had John come. And this was an absolutely amazing event because the word got out that John was going to be at Charles's class in American music, and you couldn't get in the room. People were literally sitting in the windowsills. They were hanging around outside the building to listen through the window. All the windows were up. It was a very hot spring day, and the place was unbearably hot. And John talked to the class about his usual things that he was talking about then, which was mostly how Beethoven was a bad composer and very bad for the state of the world. And if we wanted to make things better, the way was not the way of Beethoven. Of course, a lot of us were totally delighted to hear all this because it was John at his best. And of course, he spoke, everything he said was very, very soft. And you could hear a pin drop it was in Steibenhaus. Anybody listening who remembers Steibenhaus? Anyway. John, finally, this became too much for one of my classmates. He was a wonderful clarinetist named Doug DeBianco. He had quite a nice career as a clarinetist and also as a music educator. And he was a fantastic musician, and he did not hate new music, but he was really incensed at John's anti-Beethoven stance. And he sort of exploded at the end of in the question and answer period. And John sort of very quietly reiterated his stance about Beethoven not being the best thing for the world right now. and he wasn't all that great. And then Doug just exploded and he said, well, Beethoven was a great composer and you're not. And John just smiled and very quietly said, yes, but he wanted to be. Which I thought was one of the greatest answers I'd ever heard of anybody in that situation. And Doug eventually he calmed down and about it all, but I will never forget that story. But anyway, he made an impact, and he was very popular on the campus. And then he came back. Jerry Hiller, of course, brought him back to write harpsichord with Hiller. As the way they divided up, Cage would basically do the algorithms, and then Jerry would make the computer programs that would make them run. But of course, in those days, they didn't always, nothing ever ran exactly right. And what was supposed to be a one-year project turned into a two-year project.
Exactly. I know the premiere got postponed because it just couldn't get it done.
Yes, exactly. But anyway, then it got done, and it was fantastic. John actually lived on the campus as I say, played chess with the graduate students and went to faculty parties. I saw him many times socially. But the biggest event was when I, because of a long series of circumstances, I had to learn on very short notice solo 6 of harpsichord, which is
because why you lost a harpsichordist.
He withdrew. One of the harpsichordists withdrew from the project because he didn't realize. I mean, the piece is as hard as anything I've ever played in my life because of the polyrhythms involved as much as anything else. And the relentlessness of it, it's 20 minutes of just, polyrhythmic chaos.
I see.
One of the harpsichordists withdrew, and I my immediate reaction was, well, why didn't you ask me first? Because I was actually a little miffed that I wasn't involved. I felt that I should have been involved. But anyway, as fate had it, I was. But I had to not only learn the piece, I had to record it, because as I'm sure you remember, and some of our listeners will remember, but for those of you who don't know, Nonesuch Records put out one of the recording ready for the premiere so that it could be sold at the premiere. I don't think they quite made it that way, but in any event, before the piece was ever done in public, it had to be recorded and put together in the studio.
Uh-huh.
So I had the extraordinary honor of not only recording this piece, but John was my page turner. He was extremely supportive, and he wanted everything to be right, but he had a wonderful, gentle way of doing it, which was not perfectionistic. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
It wasn't like, that's okay, you play wrong notes, Neely, but it wasn't like he's beating you over the head. It completely different, but he got a very, very good result out of me by doing this. But the most amazing thing that he said, and this confirmed in my mind what a great musician he really was, because he gave me one piece of advice that I tell to all of my students, and I will remember my entire life, and it was this. He said, if you're playing a piece of music which is disjointed and made up of many different elements, which i.e., for example, a harpsichord solo 6, what you want to do is to find ways of putting it all together so it makes a big line. And he actually did a sort of line with his hand, just as you would think of a sort of grand line in romantic music. And he said, on the other hand, if a piece is very continuous, like a piece by Mozart, you should find ways to break it up.
Amazing, amazing.
Which is fantastic advice for just about any piece of music. I mean, everything is either disjointed and you need to put it together, or it's all together and you need to break it up a little
bit. Right, right. That's actually very beautiful.
It's a beautiful way of looking at all of music. Another thing that he said to me, I was working all this. I could never tell if this was a compliment, but I finally decided it was. And in any event, I took it as a compliment. He said, Neely, you play my music just like any other music.
Oh, that's so nice. No, he would like that. He meant that was a compliment.
I finally figured it was.
Yeah.
Because he was smiling when he said it, and there was no reason to think that it wasn't a compliment.
Yeah, of course, of course.
But of course, a lot of people don't. They put Cage in a corner, right? But he's not in a corner. He's part of a very big picture, which is the history of Western music.
Totally. Most people don't understand that about him. They think of him as a kind of an anomaly. But the truth is, if you read him, I love, for example, his letters that he wrote to people about Satie when he was taking them to task. He knew more about Western music than anybody gives him credit for.
Absolutely.
He was so smart. So Neely, just to for our audience, that was the harpsichord performance took place in Illinois, not at Alabama. I think we flipped into Illinois without me clarifying that we had flipped into Illinois.
Yes, but of course, we had the recent 50th anniversary of harpsichord, and also the recently in 2012, there was the 100th anniversary of Cage's birth, and we did harpsichord at Wesleyan. We did a version with three harpsichords and lots of tape recorders. And also the decor was by John Toth, one of the visual artists who did the famous performance at the Albright Knox Gallery in Buffalo, which was the grand finale of the Creative Associates.
Right. I remember.
Yes. And of course, John was there and Jerry was there, and it was a gala event. And so, and of course, I went and I played solo six. At the time, I was the only person to have played solo six, but I think somebody else has played it since. There are very few of us who play solo six in harpsichord.
Because of its difficulty?
Oh, it's phenomenally difficult. I guess the last time I played it was in 2013, I think, recently, at the I in New York City. And one of the other harpsichordists was Joseph Kubera, who's no slouch.
Right.
And plays the hardest music of anybody, you know. He came over and looked over my shoulder while I was playing a solo six, and he said, "How do you play that?" And I got a big kick out of that. And I told him how long, you know, that I told him the story I told you and our listeners about how I had to learn it under duress. But it is extremely difficult.
So that was in 1968, I think, right? The premiere was put off by 1 year. I think it was supposed to be 67.
It was in 69.
No, it was supposed to be in 68. And then it was premiered in 69.
It was in May of 1969. But anyway, it was in the spring.
Yeah.
That was a gala event. Boy, there were so many people there, thousands of people going in and out of the assembly hall at the university.
Right, we have photographs of it. It's pretty amazing.
It was astonishing.
Yeah.
I told my classes afterwards that I felt like I'd been involved in the performance of a great masterpiece, the premiere of a great masterpiece.
Of course.
Like the Beethoven Ninth.
Of course.
I think I was subconsciously ribbing Doug DiBianco, although he was never a student of mine. We were in school at the same time.
Yeah. So you stayed at Illinois. Cage didn't return to Illinois after that, right? After that period.
We had some contact, I think, maybe correspondence, maybe telephone call or something. But anyway, once I got to Wesleyan, of course, John was a regular visitor to the campus. He stayed at the Winslows for a long time. And then after Dick Winslow retired and moved to Antrim, New Hampshire, he stayed at the home of Jose de la Torre Bueno,
his editor
at Wesleyan University Press. And after he was known as Bill Bueno. And after Bill Bueno died, he would stay when he came. He would stay at the Bueno home, and was when Emily Bueno. She lived much longer than Bill, and we became very, very close friends. She was about my mother's age. She and my mother got along very, very well. Still in touch with their daughter Mary. They have another daughter, Laura. But anyway, the Buenos are worth a story. They're quite remarkable people in themselves. But anyway, John would always come to and stay with them. But he would bring his own food.
Of course.
By that time in his life, he was under doctor's orders only to eat certain things, which I'm sure prolonged his life. But anyway, he would come and eat whatever he had brought.
Right. Was he still smoking?
No, he had stopped smoking.
He had stopped smoking. I once asked him very much later than the period you're talking about if quitting smoking was hard for him, and he said, "Oh yes." And I said, "Were there particular things that were triggers for you?" And he said, "Everything."
Well, of course, my first view of John, as I mentioned, you know, was on stage in Smith Concert Hall, and of course, he had a cigarette holder.
That's right. You're talking about the performance.
How to Pass, Kick, Fall, and Run. And he was on a tower, you know, that was built up above stage level. And he had a desk, and he had a cigarette holder and a cigarette.
And a bottle of wine.
That's correct. And he would sip the wine from time to time.
Great fun.
I think he was also supposed to stop drinking wine, but I don't think he did.
He tried. That was when I was around. So that was the late 80s, where the doctors told him he really was having allergic reactions to wine. And they put him on, they recommended in its place single malt liquors.
Uh-huh.
They said were easier on the system, whereas wine was very complicated, lots of sugar. It was just more complicated for the body. And he tried that, but his heart wasn't really in it.
You know, all this is something I think people should know about John if they haven't already figured it out. And of course, anybody who knew him, this would be not news. But he was such a social animal.
Totally.
He enjoyed the company of other people. He enjoyed a good drink. He enjoyed a smoke. He enjoyed telling stories with his friends. He was very easy laughter.
Yep.
And people who didn't particularly like his music or didn't approve of him in the least really liked him socially. An example of somebody like that is Sulima Stravinsky, who was my piano teacher at the University of Illinois, Igor Stravinsky's son.
Yes.
And excellent teacher. I learned a great deal from him. But anyway, he and his wife, Françoise, were very fond of Cage, and they entertained frequently, and they had him in their houses. But you couldn't talk about John's ideas or God forbid his music around Sulima. He would become apoplectic, and I heard there's an anecdote. She didn't tell me this herself, but Françoise Stravinsky, his wife, told this story. That he got so upset, he said, "What is it about all these graduate students and they're so fond of John Cage?" And he was fulminating about John, and Françoise said, "The music means something different to them than it does to you." Which is the sort of thing you need your wife to be saying, right?
Did he accept that?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Oh, good, good. You know, the thing you said about John being so social, it made me remember something that was kind of a very sad moment, because John had died. It was about 3 or 4 days after he had died. And Merce and I were sitting in the apartment in the loft on 18th Street. And I said, "I think I'm ready for a dinner party, aren't you? You know, shouldn't we? We should have a social event." And he looked at me so serious and so sad. And he said, "Oh, Laura, no one will want to come now." And I said, oh, why do you say that? And he said, "Oh, because they all came for John, because he was so social and people loved him."
Boy, does he underestimate himself.
Of course.
That is just...
Of course.
I understand. That tells you more about how he was feeling.
Yes, of course. But it just reminded me. But it's true. You know, Cage could talk to anybody. Mm-hmm. He could hold his own with absolutely any kind of person, any profession, you know, whereas Merce was more kinetic, you know, his...
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
well,
anyway...
I have to tell you, this is triggering all kinds of anecdotes in my mind. This is a wonderful conversation. But I have to tell you about when I met Merce Cunningham. I was in graduate school and also on the faculty at the University of Illinois at the same time. And he came, and when he came to Illinois as a visitor, he stayed at the home of Ben and Betty Johnston.
Okay.
Of course, Ben and Betty had both known John forever, and Ben was the closest thing that John ever had to a student. And although John didn't like for people to say they were his students, because he said, "I never had anything to teach," which
right.
of course is not true.
Of course, of course.
But anyway, Merce was coming to town, and he was being given an award by the university. And of course, Betty Johnston was a fantastic entertainer. She was a wonderful cook, and they had the parties at the Johnston house were legendary. And so she said, "Well, Merce, obviously we have to have a dinner party for you. Who would you like for me to invite?" And Merce said, "Oh, just invite the people you would invite if John were coming." And so that's how my first wife, Jean, and I got invited to this group of astonishing dinner party. I don't even remember who was there other than Merce and the Johnsons and Jean and myself, because I was so starstruck to be in the presence of Merce Cunningham, whom I absolutely revered.
Right, right.
The god of
death. He was just convinced that, you know, nobody would want to come over now, because John had died.
Yeah, but you know, he was very, very, very charming man. Very charming.
Of course, of course.
I have one other quick anecdote about Merce and John. I remember seeing one of the things. John was still alive. Of course, Merce wrote himself into every dance that he ever did. But as he grew older, he had to have more and more specialized things to do.
Right.
And appearances on stage became smaller and smaller, but more and more spectacular. And there was I can't even remember. He just sort of ducked in from one of the sides, and he did something like
right with his upper body, his arm.
Of course, everybody was just awestruck. It was wonderful. And I was just talking to John afterwards, and I said, "Merce certainly steals the show, doesn't he?" And John smiled and said, "At his age, he has to."
Oh God, I remember one time when a critic, I want to say it was Pauline Kael, I know she was the film critic for the New Yorker, but yes. I think she had written a dance review of Merce, and she made some really snippy comment about how, maybe it's not her, I shouldn't say that it was, but whoever it was saying that Merce should get off the stage, that he's too old to be on the stage, you know, and he can't move anymore, and he should really, it's painful to watch, you know. And Merce was ranting about this. He was so mad about this review. And he was saying, "Oh, I will never dance in this town again. They'll never get me on the stage. Never, never." And John was laughing and trying not to let Merce see him laughing, because he didn't want to hurt his feelings. But he said, "Now, Merce, you know you will. You know you'll dance again."
Good for John.
Exactly. But I told Merce, you know, I said, you know, it may be so what they're saying, but that's part of the reason you're such an inspiration to so many people, myself included. That, you know, he could barely walk, and there he was on this stage finding something he could do with his
exactly.
body, and it was
exactly.
so breathtakingly beautiful, you know.
Of course, always, always. Well, it just shows you the human spirit is really something, isn't it?
his was really something. It's true.
Well, anyway, all that happened while I was at Wesleyan, and that's all part of the things we were talking about.
Yeah.
I don't know what will bring us back more directly to Wesleyan. Maybe something that the listeners will not be aware of is you know, the Étude Astrale. I think most people know that Atlas Eclipticalis was actually written at Wesleyan using star maps in the Wesleyan Observatory. But Étude Astrale was also part of that, and they were. Greta Sultan played, you know, before she played the pieces in New York, she played them lots of other places. And I remember one friend of mine who went to a private performance of these with Greta, you know, and John was there. There were like five or six people there. She was playing them just for friends, but she ended up there. And she said she had never seen anyone so totally terrified of the score.
As I mean, Greta.
Greta, she simply sat down and looked at it and just emanated terror. Then she played, of course, it was very beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, she came and did the whole thing at Wesleyan. And that was, I can't remember when it was, but I mean, John came, escorted her, you know, she was a very gracious person. And it was everybody sat enthralled with these extraordinary, beautiful
Yeah,
pieces.
yeah, yeah.
John gave me a copy of those pieces, and I worked on them for a long time, and I was able to play one page.
Really?
And
Wow.
I thought, this is not for me. But
Right.
she can play the whole thing. My colleague, John Barlow, who's also deceased, he was very fond of those pieces, and he could actually play them. But he didn't like to play in public very much, but he did play those pieces for his students.
Well, they're hard. But
They
you know,
are.
John loved Greta, but he hated traveling with her because he says she was the most nervous traveler he had ever been with. That she drove him incredibly crazy when they were on the road
So the
preparing
story,
him.
yeah, that's interesting because the story about her being terrified of the score might be just a part of her general personality.
Yeah, he just said that she was just so nervous all the time about
Yes.
traveling, about getting ready to perform, having performed. He was constantly having to bolster her. And he said
Right.
it was exhausting.
Well, I can believe it. I can believe that.
So did you lean on John for compositional advice and things like that?
I don't think he would have ever given anybody compositional
I
advice.
wouldn't think so, but
But
did
I
you
will.
talk? Okay, did you talk about your work with him?
Oh yes. Now that I remember several conversations about that. One of them was, there's one of the pieces that I'm most associated with of Cage's is songbooks, and my deceased wife Phyllis and I, along with David Baron and Mark Graff, did a four-person version of songbooks. Mark, when he moved to the West Coast, Tim Wolfe took the part that he had, and then we expanded it when we did this production for Lincoln Center Out of Doors. But anyway, one of the pieces in there is one of the Cheap Imitation series, and
I know what you're talking about. It's
it's based on the Queen of the Night's revenge aria in the Magic Flute. I performed this in this production wearing a giraffe head, and I arranged to, of course, another piece that you do in that is you have to have a you're one of the pieces is to exit the stage and enter wearing the head of an animal. Well, we all had animal heads for this. I was a giraffe. Phyllis was a zebra. David Baron had a lion's head, and Mark Graff and later Tim Wolf had an elephant's head. I still have a zebra head, and I have a picture of me after with the zebra head on as well. But anyway, we would always perform it in a space so that the giraffe head could make an entrance before I made my entrance. So in Kroll Concert Hall at Wesleyan, for example, the giraffe was seen in a staircase going to the balcony above the stage, and then sort of looked out over the stage, and then I began singing this travesty of the Queen of the Night in falsetto, sort of screaming my way through it with the giraffe head on. Well, John was just totally delighted with this. He told me on several occasions that our performance of songbooks was the best ever. And I flatter myself that he was correct. In any event, we did some things that nobody else would do, like scream the Queen of the Night in a giraffe's head.
Of
But
course, of course.
anyway, I had this idea of starting off writing a set of variations on a theme by John Cage, which would be, of course, this crazy travesty of the Queen of the Night, and it would be for four-hand pianos. And then, but each successive variation would do the process in reverse and turn it back into the Queen of the Night's aria
I
in reverse.
see, I
Come back
see, I see.
to piano. Well, John was just absolutely delighted with this. And he said, do it, do it. But I never did. But anyway, something that I did do was, and I told him about it while I was doing it, I decided, it's a lot of trouble to do a piece of music with random process. You have to set up the process, and you have to go through the the moves of actually throwing the dice or pulling the slips of paper out of the hat or whatever it is you're doing. But then there's always a certain amount of editing. It's just unavoidable. And it's all a bigger and more complicated task than you think it's going to be. And I had the idea, okay, I have this, if I write a piece that has a random process in it, I should write another piece, and it should be a gymnopedy.
Okay.
Plati's three famous gymnopedies. So I started writing random-based gymnopedies, and I have now 10 of them. Interesting people can listen to them.
Oh, great. We'll play some of them at the close of this program, which, by the way, is creeping up on us.
Oh, very good.
Neely, you and I could probably talk for hours.
Well, absolutely. We should do this again.
Without breathing.
Exactly. We have only touched on the Big Cage.
I know. It's true.
In 1988 at Wesleyan, and we should. But anyway, we've talked about maybe having other interviews, and maybe we will. I'm up for it if you are.
Oh, but totally, totally. I really still want very much, because you're a teacher and I'm a teacher, and I would love us to talk about teaching chants, teaching.
Oh, yes. Oh,
I think that would be so interesting.
Well, we don't have time now to do that, but I have plenty of things. When the occasion arises, I have plenty to tell you about that, because I've been doing it systematically with my students for a long time at Wesleyan.
Yeah, no, I know. I know more than anybody I know, Neely, I'm sure. But let's just say we'll do another program sometime in the near future. We're just going to record it and we'll just do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, good. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Totally a pleasure for me too. So take care of yourself, Neely. I'll edit this program. I'll add some gymnopedies, and I'll let you know when the show's going to air.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you, Neely. It was a great pleasure.
And talking about John is always an honor.
For me too. Thanks.
So long.
Bye. Now on to Neely Bruce's gymnopedies. These are, in this order, number 4, number 9, number 1, number 10, number 6, number 2, and number 3. And as I said, you can access these easy peasy on SoundCloud. Enjoy. Thank you.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.